I think an integral part of leadership is probably in the area of communication. And as I've traveled around to various parts of the world, been in some of your regions, and actually spent time with some of you personally, I'm amazed at how many times that I run into difficulties in a local ministry that I could really attribute to a breakdown in communications. I keep hearing a phrase that I'm not being heard. A two-way communication. First, a breakdown in vertical, meaning coming down to them, but also a breakdown in the upward vertical move, that I'm not being heard. I'm saying things, but people aren't listening. Attitudes develop because of that. And I think the communication is a vital part. It happens in just about every realm of endeavor. I have a little reading here entitled "The Operation of the Chain of Command," or "It Happens Every Day, Even Among the Best." The colonel, commanding officer, called his exec in one day and he said this: "At 9 o'clock tomorrow, there will be an eclipse of the sun, something which does not occur every day. Get the men to fall out in the company street in their fatigues so that they will see this rare phenomenon, and I will explain it to them. In case of rain, we will not be able to see anything, so take the men to the gym." "Yes, sir." So the exec called the company commander in and told the captain this. He said, "By order of the colonel, tomorrow at 9 o'clock there will be an eclipse of the sun. If it rains, you will not be able to see it from the company street. So then, in fatigues, the eclipse of the sun will take place in the gym. Something which does not occur every day." "Yes, sir." So the captain called the lieutenant in and told the platoon leader this. Said, "By order of the colonel, in fatigues, tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning, the inauguration of the eclipse of the sun will take place in the gym. The colonel will give the order if it should rain. Something which does not occur every day." "Yes, sir." The lieutenant called the sergeant in and said this: "Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, the colonel, in fatigues, will eclipse the sun in the gym. As it occurs every day if it's a nice day, but if it rains, well, then in the company street." "Yes, sir." The sergeant called the corporal in and said, "Tomorrow at 9, the eclipse of the colonel, in fatigues, will take place by cause of the sun. If it rains in the gym, something which does not happen every day, it'll take place in the company street." And the corporal said, "Well, Sergeant, if you say so." And here's what the privates were saying among themselves: "Tomorrow, if it rains, it looks as if the sun's going to eclipse the old man in the gym. It's a shame that doesn't happen every day." Communication gets garbled for a variety of reasons. And we can certainly see the importance of it. I think maybe one of the most sensitive places for effective communication is in the home. Have you found that? Husband and wife. The other day, my wife was coming down the stairs. We were getting ready to go somewhere. She just looked radiant. She looks more lovely to me every day. I've only been married 27 years, and it gets better all the time. There she was coming down the stairs. She was smiling. And I said, "Honey, you look lovely today." And she said, "Today." I said, "You know, I'm thinking, how did I blow that one?" I didn't think there was any way to get that one out of order. But communication does occur. I've got a 14-year-old in my house. Somebody asked me how old she is, and I say she's 14 going on 20. That she rides an up-and-down pattern. She told me the other day, she said, "Daddy, you just don't seem to understand what I say." I thought about that, and I said, "You know, I believe that's true. I'm having a difficult time." I said, "Would you believe that it's hard for me to understand what you say? That I'm having difficulty identifying with some of the things that are going on, that the family is so sensitive. And in the ministry, do you find that difficult to make sure that you really are saying what you mean and meaning what you say, and that others are understanding and responding effectively to that?" It's ever present. And I think that things communicate what we do, what we have before us, how we spend time, our attitude. There's almost nothing that has zero communication. Have you noticed that silence? Somebody says something, there's dead silence. Does that have a communication? It really does. So psychologists say that it's impossible to have no behavior, that zero behavior is a type of behavior. And communication may be somewhat like that in some respects, that it may be impossible to have zero communication. Let's look at a few concepts about communication. Let's begin with perhaps an expanded definition or some ideas about the term. Communication is made possible through the medium of the communicator. That's the living person. That's you. The way to establish the communication is through the communicator himself. For the message and the messenger must become one. When the message is incarnated in, the messenger is made alive, really living in the messenger. Then the message is not an idea, but an event. It's a happening. It's an involvement. The old phrase or idea, nothing but the facts, sir, just won't cut it. The Joe Friday thing on the old Dragnet series when he was trying to talk to a lady and invariably one of the women wants to give him all the details and how she feels about it. He wants to stop her. Ma'am, I only want the facts. There was a 206 in progress and I only want the facts. No feelings, nothing else to go with it. Just the information. Just the ideas. But I'm suggesting that communication is much more than facts. It's much more than words. There's a factor of you involved. And the insertion of you into this process is so critical that most people, honestly, I believe, are not just interested in what you say, but they are more interested in how you feel about what you say. You say a thing and they don't know how you really feel about it. Or they misinterpret it. That's a tough one, isn't it? You say a thing and they misinterpret it. That's not the way I feel about it. Well, the idea then is that we'll have some concepts, some words, but we'll have ideas and how you feel about them. To have an event in communication would be your personal involvement with others. And obviously implied here at the outset that we have to have a minimum of two people who desire to communicate. Can be two or more, but an honest desire to have some type of communication. If they don't have that desire, then it's going to be probably purposely misinterpreted. They will take you wrong. Oh, I like a red shirt. Oh, you don't like a blue shirt? You know, they'll pick up on that because there's really no desire to be involved in the communication. And we'll get the thing snarled right at the outset. Well, to help us get a little bit of a handle, I would propose us to look at several aspects. One, the first hour this morning, the last hour this morning, but the first hour of this, that I'd like us to look at a process. It's a block diagram of some important issues that we need to consider as communicators. And that will be a summary of the communication process handout that you have. And if you'd like to take notes, you may want to jot in a few things on that. Later, we will look at some ideas of feedback. Treat that as a very specialized subject. Probably relate it somewhat to the concept of how to render an effective critique using feedback as a primary approach. Then we'd like to look a little bit at the use of questions in our communication. And probably then later in the day, we'll look at some listening, a few listening skills. I have a tape that I've extracted some excerpts from. Probably just a few minutes of that. Give you an opportunity through four listening situations to see how effective you are at listening. There'll be a little write-down exercise just for your own information after each exercise. And then some feedback from me on what the keyed response is, meaning the ideas that the person who wrote the script felt were key, and see how well yours matched with them. Then we'll conclude by putting the whole thing back together just for a few minutes to see that there really are some important pieces involved in our whole process. So that will then take us over a total of three periods, the one between now and lunch, and then in the afternoon there'll be two other periods set aside for that. Let's begin by looking at the communication process. You'll notice that we have a sender and a receiver, two smileys, and a miscommunication with a light bulb. The light bulb implies to most people ideas. I would like for it to imply more than that, ideas and feelings. We have the sender who has some ideas and some feelings about those ideas that he would like to see over here with the receiver so that the receiver understands and has a response. If we were to put a very much oversimplified view, we could say that the sender has a goal, and the goal would be a purpose, an objective. It's a reason for communicating, not just idle chatter, but something he would like to, some purpose he would like to see achieved. And probably the result of that communication, we could call a reaction, that the receiver is to get the ideas and the feelings and have a response, probably one that the sender was hoping for. It may or may not be that, but at least he wants some type of response. Then how do we do it? We might call that action, some type of action in order to achieve that. And one way of looking at that is to say then that that action would be the use of the communication process. You'll notice that there's some barriers, one for the sender and one for the receiver. And it's pretty obvious that we do have, each have our own barriers. That is, I, as a sender, I have some barriers of my own that I communicate through. And you as a receiver receive through your own barriers. And we'll see some illustrations of some things that might go in there. We'll see that they're physical barriers. That the message, meaning the ideas and the feelings, have to ride through these barriers on a channel, meaning one or more of our senses, over to the receiver. And all the time that that's occurring, there's probably a feedback loop that needs to be recognized. The receiver's giving feedback. Now, that feedback may be a nod of the head, an uh-huh. It might be a staring at the ceiling. It might be a frown. It might be an interruption in a statement to give you some verbal feedback. But it's a two-way process. And that when the receiver then changes roles and gives feedback, he has to go through the same functions. Well, let's take a look at some of the personal barriers. There should be an et cetera down at the bottom of each one of these. Even though the transparency is designed primarily on a personalized base, meaning you as a sender or you as a receiver, it implies one-to-one. But let me assure you that the very same principles apply if you're in a group. And during this whole time, you'll be in group involvement. And I think sensitivity to some of these concepts as you communicate, so that you can communicate more effectively in your work group, as you can give honest feedback, effective feedback that's not only understandable, but that will be responded to. That type of a concept, that it's not only personalized one-to-one, but it's one-to-many. It can happen in a group the same way. In fact, I would submit that in a group you face some other problems, that if you violate or misuse these barriers, you're not considering some of these factors. You'll find that not only does the person you're speaking to in a group have a response or maybe a reaction, maybe a negative one, but the whole group may have that. So if you have some offensiveness, some negatives in your communication pattern, they'll come out on a one-to-one basis, but they'll probably also come out in a group. So to make that clear, that these patterns you'll find useful throughout your time here as well as in your ministry on a personalized base. We'll take these a few at a time and talk our way through some of them. That communicative skill, whose communicative skill should you focus on? If you're the sender, whose skill should you focus on to be effective? Well, we probably need to give consideration to both of ours, but if I focus on mine, what will that cause me to do? Use my background and my experience and my knowledge as opposed to capitalizing on where he is. Might I be wiser if I would focus on his? Find out what terms communicate to him, what patterns, what skill areas he has. If I decided to do that, how might I find out what his skill level is? How am I going to get him to talk? Ask him questions. And listen, and I think the word listen means more than hear. Listen means more than hear. That was brought forcefully home to me just the other day. We'll pick up on this and we'll talk our way through. You'll have an opportunity to get them. But the other day I was watching the evening news, the early evening news, and I had a newspaper in one hand, watching the television in the other. I've made a commitment to keep up with what's going on in the world. And God has given me an uncanny ability to one eye on the paper and one eye on the television and even an ear to listen in to what else is going on. So my wife came downstairs and I'm watching, I'm reading and watching and reading. She said something to me and I said, yes. And I went on watching and reading. She said something. I said, I don't think that'd be the thing to do. And I said, yes to the third question. She said, you're not listening to me. I closed the paper. I turned around and I quoted verbatim the last three sentences. Without missing a word. I said, sure. I was listening. I heard every word you said. That just proves it that I heard it. That I'm able to quote it verbatim. Of course, that made her altogether happy. And then she said, well, you didn't act like you were listening. I said, well, what would you like me to do? And she said, look at me. When I'm talking, I'd like you to look at me. And I said, I put it all down. I said, okay. I'll look. Now I'm looking. Tell me what you want to tell me. I made a bit of a joke out. It's better than an argument, believe me. That's a whole lot better than an argument. You know that I have a backup when I get too far out of order. I wave a white flag and then I'll back up a little bit. And you know, that's to have a reconnoiter and a little discussion on the matter. So I decided I would talk to her. I said, is this really better? You tell me now what you want to tell me. And I looked her right in the eye and said, with a tender, loving smile, I do love that gal. That's not a put on to look at her like I love her. I looked at her and I listened, and boy, that was a lot better. Then it struck me after that that hearing is not listening necessarily. That the principle of listening is to hear the words, to interpret them, and have some response. To be a receiver on the communication link. And I think it's so important that we respond in a communication pattern. So if I want that other person to respond, I need to ask some questions and listen to them. Not just listen for a moment, meaning till I can get my thoughts together for me to take over the conversation. Values are certainly important. Whose values, if I'm going to have an effective communication, whose values should I be very sensitive of? Why? What happens when you violate a person's values? What happens to communication? They don't listen. They cut it off. Man, I've had that. It's all over. Whatever the value is. Now, it doesn't mean that I have to agree with their values. Not at all. But I need to be sensitive to them and recognize them. And I would suggest rather than attack their values, probably support the values that you hold as dear. For example, a non-believer just in evangelism. Instead of attacking something he thinks is a value, I like to support what I consider a value. And I'll listen to him. Hear what he says. I've heard that. And I could understand how you might feel that way. Let me share an alternative. And then give him an alternative. Share what the Word says. And what you found in life and experience. It makes a big difference. As opposed to violating values. Years ago when the hippie movement was in full swing, I had a real giant problem. It was difficult for me to adjust to the exceedingly long hair, the dirty clothes, the live-in-the-commune situation, the anti-God, the anti-everything that I'd considered as values. So when I came upon some hippies rejecting their lifestyle, guess what else I communicated? Rejection of them. One of my daughters pointed that out. Said, Daddy, when you talked to that fellow, it seemed as though you were rejecting him. And I thought through. Yes, I had. I really had. I'd rejected him, not just his lifestyle. And I began to pray about that, and I considered in my life that supernatural, to be able to accept the person at the same time I reject his behavior and his value systems. If you've never prayed about that, there might be a point of application for you to ask God to give you that ability to do it, to be able to accept the person and reject their lifestyle, to love them and totally reject the sin in their life. I believe it is supernatural. I think probably there's a verse that comes to mind that would summarize much of our communicative efforts. And I'd like to suggest that you turn to Colossians 4:6. Because about now, I think we see that we do have a need in our life. If we're going to be effective, that we're going to have to turn to God with this. That these principles, after having introduced one or two of them, it should be evident that we're going to need some help with this. I don't believe it's a matter of doing it simply by decision. The concept of putting my will to it. Well, I think will, yes, but God's power. When I put my will to God's power and exercise proper willpower, then I think it will work. So Colossians 4:6, let me ask you, not to answer, but you answered in your heart. Have you ever prayed that verse into your life? Have you ever asked, phrase at a time that God put those issues into your life? And my guess is that there are several here who have not. I'd like to make that a point of application early. Would you with me, as you look at that verse, be willing to consider praying it into your life if you've never done it? If you have, you may want to refresh that prayer. I remember some years ago when that verse really impacted me. And I said, Lord, please, by your power and strength, in your spirit, give me speech, conversation, communication. That's always with your grace. Now that's prompted by, controlled by, undergirded by, directed by God. To give me speech, Lord, please. That's always with your grace. In every situation, always with your grace. Seasoned with salt. Now what does that mean, seasoned with salt? What would be the characteristic of the speech? It's tasty. Yeah, it's good. It's tasty. It's palatable. It's even desirable when it's properly seasoned. A person that I know once said, well, salt has a stinging effect to it. That when you take a lot of salt, it stings, especially if you get in a cut. But I said, that to me is not the purpose of salt. You know, salt, you put it on food to make it tasty. So to me, speech that's always with grace seasoned with salt would be that the speech is tasty and receivable. And I think God would be the power source for having that. Seasoned with salt in order to do what? And then, Lord, help me to know how to answer every person. To be able to communicate with a janitor on one hand and the president of the university on the other. For whatever the range. With foreign students. With whomever. Males, females, old and young. Whoever, that I might know how I ought to answer every person. Did you pray that through? Just now, did you ask the Lord to give you that kind of speech? You see, if you didn't, and you were looking for these things to do it, then you're going to be sorely disappointed. Because these principles won't achieve it. But in the power of God, as the Holy Spirit's working in our lives, praying through instances, pausing long enough to listen. A situation comes up and an answer is needed. That happened to me some weeks ago over here at the King James. There were some people sitting around the table, and there's a bright young fellow from a college ministry asked me a real loaded question. I'd never considered the question. I took a long drink of that my iced tea and I put it back down and began to answer his question. And I gave him a scripture passage and we discussed it. And that happened three times. Three passages, three pieces of discussion and a little summary. They didn't have a poem to go with that. I just had 3 points. So when we finished, he said, thanks a lot. And I said, now to set the record straight, when you asked me that question, let me tell you what happened. Do you remember that I took that glass of tea? Well, he didn't even remember it. I said, I remember it. I took a long, slow drink and I put that down. I said, during that process of that time, what I said was, Lord, you know that I don't have the foggiest notion what the answer to that question is. If you would like me to answer it, you're going to have to prompt me with your answer because I don't know an answer. And by the time I got the glass down on the table, there it was. Bang. He'd recall the passage of Scripture. And as I went through those three passages and had a little discussion, I got just as much instruction and learning as he did because we were both starting from the same point. And it had to be effective because it wasn't mine that I prayed and asked God to do that. I think associated with Colossians 4:6 is taking the time to listen and also Isaiah 30:21. And thine ears shall hear a word behind thee saying, this is the way. Walk in it when you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left. To be able to hear God prompting you. And so many times what I hear is a simple recall of things he's already said. Occasionally it'll be a new insight or a new understanding about it. But to take the time to listen, take the time to ask, to have prayed that passage in your life. Have you ever asked for a set of spiritual ears to hear the word behind you? I was raised an empiricist. A numbers game fella. Those 5 years I spent at Cape Canaveral that we didn't launch until all systems were go. And we had to count and weigh and measure everything. Later when I got exposed to psychology, it was hard for me to accept their research as data because there are too many uncontrollables. See, we would have thrown that right out the window and laugh at it. Because an empiricist then says you have to number everything and you have to control all the variables so that you only have one. Well, that's impossible with people. So I'm still trying to make that adjustment. Bob's smiling at me back there. He knows that I'm still working on that adjustment, that I haven't quite made it yet. But you have to consider these things. An empiricist would look at numbers. And I've been trying to pray another aspect into my life. And a few years ago, a fellow said, I believe you're almost totally subjective. And I laughed at that. I said, well, it may appear that way because I'm making an intense prayer effort and I'm making a personal focus on it. But believe me, I feel a lot more comfortable when I can get the numbers down there and run them through the computer because that's my lifestyle. I was, among other things, I had a math science major in undergraduate school and 5 years at the Cape. You know, that thing gets ingrained in you. So I think to be able to pray for a set of ears to hear the word behind you, boy, that was an unusual thought for me. I wasn't able to do that. I'd heard a man talk about it, and I said, I'm not able to identify with what you're saying. He said, have you ever asked for that? I said, well, no, I never did. He said, well, how in the world do you expect to have it if you've never asked? You have not. Why? Because you ask not. And the promise is clear. Ask and you'll receive. That's what I'm suggesting. Colossians 4:6, Isaiah 30:21. Then I think we can respond easier to communicative skills and to values. Of course, knowledge and experience goes hand in glove. Being able to understand a person's background. Yesterday I had a workshop using some of this same material for our local conference, and there were mostly couples and quite a few older people in there and a lot of women. And I used an illustration. I said, the other day I was in my car driving and I came up to this curve, and just as I went into it, I began to get a sensation because of the curve. It was a lot like kicking rudder. It put me into it as you'd put an aircraft into a yaw. Do you know what that feels like? I asked the group that, and of course they didn't, because they weren't pilots. They'd never done that kind of a thing. See, it had to be a dumb illustration, wouldn't it? If I'd wanted to talk about the feeling, I should have described it by following through with the car. That when you, if you've been around a reverse curve, you know, most curves should be banked to take you around like that. If you ever been on one that was sort of flat and you start around, what happens? Throws you to the outside of the car, doesn't it? That was a sensation. Did you understand that? That's a lot better illustration, isn't it, for people who weren't pilots. Now, if they were all pilots, I could go with case number one. But if I'm going to consider knowledge and experience of the person, then I need to focus on what their background is, some things that they would be interested in. I think in our ministry that we pick up a lot of, we've developed our own jargon as well as methodology and a lot of other things. Newcomers have some difficulty with that. We'll talk maybe about that in a few minutes. Attitudes, I would probably suggest to focus over here first. For most all of these, I suggest a focus on the right-hand side, but attitudes being maybe a notable exception. If your attitude is not proper, what will happen to the initial communication? See, you can cut that off. If you act a little, I remember one fellow used to speak to a group, the first time he'd spoken to a new group, this is the way he looked. And he talked to the people, very stately, with his head held high. And what kind of an attitude do you think that portrayed? Especially when he had very precise diction and his whole pattern was one of precision, then what would that communicate? That's exactly what it communicated. We had one of our own staff some time back said a friend of his had suggested that he discuss matters with me about his communication. He said he had been accused of being arrogant in his presentations. I said, well, I've only heard you one time in a group. That was several years ago, but if you would like my honest feedback, that was the same impression that I had. I said, let me talk to you about your attitude. So we talked about it, and his attitude was not arrogant. It was, if anything, it was the other way. He felt a little insecure. He felt a lot insecure, as a matter of fact, and he was not feeling superior in any way. Well, I asked him to give me about 15 minutes of some formal presentation. He did that, and I put that on videotape. We recorded it. Then I asked him just to sit in the chair, and he sat down, and I turned the camera around and punched the go button, and he and I had a conversation. And I finally found an issue that really was dear to his heart. It motivated him. It excited him. And he got involved in it. And we did that for about 10 minutes, and I cut it off. Then I showed him both replays. And I said, honestly, which one did you like the best? He said, well, by far the second. And I said, why? Well, he wasn't altogether sure, but as we discussed it, we got about five or six things that were heavy contrast. On the formality, somewhere back there, he was playing a role, and the role was miscommunicating. He was communicating an attitude to the people, and that attitude turned the communication off. The people didn't listen to what he was saying, and as a listener, evidence is clear that one of the most difficult things to listen through is the person himself. That when a person starts talking, the first barrier you have to overcome is him. His attitude. How does he come across? And if an attitude is one of arrogance or rejection or hostility or whatever, it's probably not going to be effective. Then after your attitude's looked at, then focus on the attitude of the receiver. And I think you can decide an attitude if he becomes argumentative that you're not going to argue. Can you do that? Fella came that I'd been having a series of running arguments with my whole life. I used to love to do that. I'd intellectualized four or five fields, and I had run arguments out. I knew where they led. I knew where the pitfalls were intellectually. I used to go out and start them, you know, just for kicks. I know some other people who used to like to do that, but I did. I used to love to do that. If you go out and start an argument. Well, this young man and I'd have a set of running arguments. And I had gotten impacted by a scripture passage in 2 Timothy 2, 23 through 25. You know, the pastor servant of the Lord must not strive. I'd been striving with this guy, really arguing with him. And the Lord convicted me of it. And I said, Lord, please help me not to do that anymore. So here he came. Boy, he had a new piece of information. He was going to thrust the sword and twist it a little bit. And he made the insertion. And right up in my face, you know, just waiting on me to grab that bait and take off. And the Lord reminded me of that passage. And I said, I seem to sense that you'd like me to argue with you today. Is that right? And I smiled at him. And he thought a minute. He said, well, yeah, I guess I did. And I said, well, you can't have one with me. I've decided not to. And I told him tenderly and gently, and that softened it down. And instead of arguing every time we met, we then began to relate to one another. And he ended up letting me share the gospel with him, even though he didn't make a decision. And years later, he looked me up some way or another from some mailing roster to get my name, because I'd moved several times, just to write me and let me know how he's doing. That an attitude, if his attitude is one of argumentation, I don't have to do that. I can decide after I've run my attitude check. Physical senses on the part of the receiver, to be aware of that. If you spoke very softly and a little bit behind me on my left side, you might not get a response. And you might say, boy, he's snooty. He's stuck up. He's arrogant. He won't even say hello. But I have several problems that I'm aware of. One of them is that I've lost about half the hearing in my left ear. I worked too long on the flight line in Germany for 3 years, but less than 1,000 yards from afterburner ignition. Where the big thunder goes off, you know, and they do it in a sequence every 15 seconds during lunchtime. And it literally has destroyed part of my hearing. So I don't hear well. You need to take that into consideration if you're talking with me. If you want to whisper to me, don't do it in my left ear, please. A rock came up a few minutes ago and squatted down on my left side. And I had that weird exercise of turning my right ear around. He was just off to my left a little bit. And I did it like this so I could hear what he was saying. I simply didn't hear out of that ear that well when he's speaking softly. I walked into the University of Tennessee some years ago. And there were two fellas, you know, doing this. And I looked and I said, well, let's see. They may both be deaf, and that's the only way they can communicate. One of them might be deaf and the other one might be an interpreter. Or they both might be students. We had a deaf ed department, and they might have been practicing. Well, I thought I'd take a chance. I don't know that two-hand thing, but in the Boy Scouts years ago, I'd learned fingerspelling. I just walked by and said, hi, H-I. One of them's face brightened up, and he gave me a high back, and the other fellow said, oh, do you communicate with the deaf? And, of course, I figured out then who was who. And I said, well, I learned the fingerspell a little bit, and he introduced me, and I told him, and I'm B-I-L-L. My name's Bill. He spelled out his name and we shook hands. We became friends. And he asked me to be his interpreter. We were in a graduate school together. And several classes we had together, I was his interpreter. It was a real joy to get to know the guy. I even would offer comments for him. I'd raise my hand and say, Jerome would like to make a comment. And I would make the comment for him. And then I'd give him the feedback if there was any. We became pretty good friends. One day I asked him to stay after school. And he stayed. And I told him that God loves you. And in the nasal sound that deaf people frequently have, he said, I know that. He said, I know that. I said, how? He said, the first time I touched you to get your attention, you did not back away from me. He said, everybody backs off when I touch them. There was a strong communication. I didn't even remember it. But I had no desire to back away from him because I really did care for the fellow. But it would never have crossed my mind if he hadn't said it. The simple matter of not withdrawing, of not backing up 6 inches, of not turning sideways, of looking over to someone else and breaking the eye contact. That had communicated to him that I loved him. And then I told him that I was a Christian. He knew that. And I asked him how. Well, he had some behavior characteristics. But I shared the gospel all the way through. And he told me at the end that he really had prayed and asked Christ into his life. But the communicative principles, the sensitivity in communicating with someone who has a physical sense problem, to be aware of it and make responses that are needed, that don't do it over here on our terms, the thing we've always done the same way, here's a new situation. We're going to have to be sensitive to the receiver or we'll just destroy that altogether. Of course, the physical conditioning, if you're ill, you're running a fever, you're nauseous, whatever. You're tired. You've been on an airplane for 15 hours, especially with United on strike. They put you up in Salt Lake and routed you by a 3,000-mile trip out of the way. Some of you basically had that. I talked to a fellow last night from South Carolina, and he'd gone back in the South two or three little legs, and he ended up in Salt Lake City and got a car and drove it over here. The fellow was tired when he got in last night. There would have been no point for me to try to have an extensive conversation with him. I need to be aware of that. Of course, semantics, the use of words, what do they mean? Let me hear from you some of our semantics terms that we use in the navigators. When you first came around, can you recall, were there some that tended to bother you a little bit? Get excited. That came up yesterday. Any others? Share. Something else.
My man.
My man. As opposed to whose man?
Cousin.
Uh-huh. Strong implications in that one, aren't there? Yes, sir.
Get time.
That came up yesterday, too, very forcefully.
Sharp guy.
There's one parallel to that they brought up. Man. Key man. That's it. You get it nearly every time. What else?
Tubit.
It's what?
Tubit.
Okay.
Gunner.
Trooper.
The gang.
Let's see, that's golden-hearted crunch bird. I don't know exactly what that is. I'm still working on that one. The TMS, STS, QRZ, I don't know what else goes in there. All the acronyms. The one that really threw me was a sweet young girl one day said, the thing that bothers me about navigators is, I said, what? And she said, it doesn't matter what I say. I get a I can tell them, hey, I'm not well. And they say, And they say, well, I did well with that last night. It's the same There's no differences. She says, I can't interpret that. I don't even know what that means. And it seems as though most navigators do that. So I said, well, whatever it is, the semantics situation is considerable, isn't it? And when we communicate with others, we need to be aware of that. Verbalisms is a simple use of words over and over. How do we use them and what do they mean? Not just the terms themselves, but our whole approach to it. I remember one other person said, yeah, that one thing that got me about navigators early, that there are people who pray with the word just. Lord, just do this and just do that. And after about the third time in 20 seconds in a prayer, this person had wondered, what do you mean just? That, you know, it may be a giant thing. It might not be a just do it. Why do we use just? And they didn't understand that. I smiled at first at that. And then the next time I prayed. Whose interests? Obviously, a focus on the receiver's interests. Can you make that genuine? Suppose the subject matter is not of interest to you. Can you still be interested in them and in turn that will cause you to show some interest in the subject matter? See, I think that's the middle attitude. Again, you may have to ask God to work that one for you. Bob and I went out several years ago. It had been quite a few years now in evangelism at Maxwell Air Force Base. And we contacted this one fellow that his vital interest was track. I forget how we found that out, but he was vitally interested in that subject. Believe me, I can care less about that. But I had made it a point that I'm going to read through the papers to find out what's going on. And I saw that the Southeastern Conference was having a track meet in Montgomery that week. And I read just a little excerpt. I didn't spend 15 seconds hardly with the whole thing. But when he brought it up, I mentioned the track meet. Oh, yeah, he's going. Who do you think's favorite? Well, he knew the favorite, obviously. And I think I remembered the 2-3 sequence of who was supposed to win. And I could chime that in. And maybe the name of one guy. And that was it. That's all I knew. But I interacted with him. And that guy really picked up on that, proceeded to give us ideas about track and how he felt he did running himself. And then we were able to swing it over fairly sensitively into a spiritual realm and got to share the gospel with him. But had I come on my interest thing, it would have been another subject. It would probably have been fishing. A fellow asked me, told a guy this past week, I said, ask me about fishing. Say, Bill, how much do you like fishing? Do you like fishing? And I said, I like it. And he looked at me kind of funny. I said, I like it. Another guy said, how much? And I said, lots. And I said, now on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do I like it? They said 2, 3. One guy said, I like it probably the least of anybody in here, and I believe you like it less than I do. We went around the room, and one guy said 8. I said, why'd you say 8? He said, man, I'm from where you are, and I know what the word lots means. When you said lots, I believed you. Lots is lots, and I know what that means. It's at least 8 on a scale of 10, 1 to 10. I said, well, the truth, on a scale of 1 to 10, it looks more like 11. Then I really like to fish, that I did it sinfully for years. I even have a life verse out of the first book of the Bible. God addressed the issue so clearly in Genesis 1:26, when he said, let us make man in our image after our likeness and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea. And I said, yes, sir. I really want to work at that. And I worked at it diligently and intensely, and I got the thing all out of whack. But you see, you wouldn't have believed me that I liked it, would you? That going with my verbalism has to be some other supporting piece of information. Now, years ago, I met an area representative with the navigators who told me it's a thing. And I asked some questions, and he told me the same words. And I came and asked another question, and he told me the same words. And the third time of that, he looked me right in the eye and said, I sense that you may want me to show some kind of emotion. And he had to believe me. There had been none. I said, well, I don't know that I'm looking for emotion. I'm looking for some understanding of how you feel about it. I heard what you said, but I don't have the foggiest notion of how you feel about it. He said, I decided when I was 12 years old that I would never show emotion. Ever. I said, well, from my standpoint, that's dishonesty. Because you keep me in the dark. That's purposely misleading me. Because I won't know how to interpret it. I can hear the words, but I don't know what they mean. That's not honesty. I need to know what you say and what do you mean about what you say. And if people are always having to ask you, what do you mean by that, or asking qualifying questions, you probably haven't communicated it. You've gotten the ideas, but they don't know how you feel about it. And I'm confident that there's several in here that probably have that problem, and it is a problem. You'll say a thing and people don't know how to interpret it. They don't know what the level is, because somewhere back there, we taught that a quiet and gentle spirit is one that whispers and never shows any emotion, ever. Now, I don't believe in emotionalism as a way of life. I rejected that years ago, and I believe that my mind needs to be in control, because being renewed in the spirit of your mind, that concept. So I'm not willing to live by emotionalism, but emotions were given by God. Can you see Jesus driving the money changers out with something that says, you men have desecrated my Father's temple. Leave. Is that the way he did that? With no emotional overtone to that. Do you conceive of that even in the wildest stretch of your imagination? See, I know better than that. When I read that, I know that when the Bible says he drove them out, that he drove them out. And it wasn't that little quiet, no control, almost no inflection in the voice, that I'm only going to give the facts, sir, nothing but the facts. That there was an emotional overtone that communicated the truth of how he felt about that. And when he drove them out, every man there knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that he detested desecrating his Father's house. There was not a question in anybody's mind. Some of you in here might remember some time ago when we had a workshop and a question was raised. And I asked one of the members in there, how do you feel about this thing? And he said, I like it. And we went around and did the same thing that I had done to me about fishing. And it was 1, 2, 4, 3, 2, 8, 2, 3, 1. And I asked the one fellow, I said, why did you rate him 8? He said, well, I know him and I know how much he likes it. Then I turned to the man, I said, what is the figure? And he said, 7. I said, would it surprise you that we didn't believe you? We didn't believe you. that the verbal thing by itself, pure verbalisms, may not get it done. Our interest, when we get on that, is it really an interest subject for us? Can we become interested in someone else's? That'll communicate. Of course, emotions are a vital part and not to be overcome by it. But if someone's too emotional, you may have to let them calm down. Probably will, because it's very difficult. Of course, needs, personal needs of the individual. Social, cultural norms. There are certain people and certain patterns of life that you need to be aware of. There are certain terms that you simply don't use among certain groups. Racial terms. There are economic terms that are offensive to some people. And there are other terms that have an emotional overtone. See, you can tell by now that I really grew up in Maine. That I'm a New Englander. No, you can't tell that. A fella told me, he said, "Bill, you're not getting the grits out of your mouth very quick. You've been out here 2 years and you haven't got the grits out of your mouth." Can you believe he'd say that? I said, "Well, where in the world did you get the idea I'm trying to get rid of them? Can you feature what? I'm going home, Lord willing, in June. And if my mother were to say, 'Son, you sound like a..." Can't say it. If she were to say that I sounded like that, that'd tear me to pieces. I'm not about to do that. No, sir. But you see that? There are certain terms that have emotional overtones to them. And they're instilled from childhood. And in our communication, simply to be aware of it. So you can accuse a fellow, you can call him a name, and some of them don't upset him. Other names upset him. Some terms just have a negative overtone. We need to be aware. Of course, these would be barriers, and they're physical barriers that we have to overcome. We need quickly to see that we have ideas and feelings. Now, we said that already, that that's our message, the ideas, and how do we feel about those ideas? Some recent studies have indicated that from 40 up to 80% of the impact of communication comes off the feeling issue. Not the words, but the feeling. And the feeling, in turn, comes primarily from your nonverbal. It wasn't what you said, it was the way that you said it. We saw the physical barriers of noise, light. I think those are pretty evident just by a glance. We also have the channel. Now, that would be one or more of our senses. Of course, the hearing being the verbal. The see and feel, smell and taste being primarily the nonverbal. We'll spend some more time with that this afternoon, but I think we do need to see that pattern. And as we then associate our feedback loop with it, we fairly well completed the communication process. That being overcoming barriers to get our message on a channel from a sender to a receiver with appropriate feedback. Now, that's personal involvement. You are mentally and emotionally involved in the communication. Now, I've got a misnomer here, perhaps. These are personal barriers only if they work against you. Suppose you recognize these things. You know a fellow's skill and his background and his knowledge. Then it wouldn't be a barrier, would it? Hopefully that's what we'd be shooting for, to be able to know those things and use them. So I would suggest you may want to just, in parentheses above, put perception. That those things will allow you to perceive not only of another person, but the circumstances and the involvement, the environment that you're in. So personal barriers then would become perception. And perception being a pretty key issue for us, because we don't all perceive the things exactly alike. Let me give you a couple of perception cases to show that we might not all look at it alike. Now, some of you I know have been, those of you who have been through this, don't give me away. Let's let the newcomers work on that. There's a one-question test. Have you got the keyed response? Which one does not belong? Which one seems out of order to you? Number two. How many feel that yo-yo is probably out of order? Well, that's the majority. Some of you know it's a trick question. Others have seen it. But you see, I happen to have an electric yo-yo. And it lights up. See? So obviously, I don't need the plug. I need the yo-yo and the wire and the battery and the bulb. I need a switch and a case. But I don't need the plug. That's a shame that all of you were wrong. But obviously, I'm right. That I know what it is. And do we do that? How often do we do that? It's Especially when we're dealing with young people coming around and it's their first effort. We tell them very authoritatively in a dominating attitude, this is right, I'm right, and you're wrong. And it's no wonder people have a response. Here's another one I'd like you to do, to count the number of times the letter F appears. The letter F, A, B, C, D, E, F. Now, two constraints. One, that you only do it one time through. And secondly, that you do it as quickly as you can. All right? And when you finish, look over at me. The number of times the letter F appears in that one sentence. Quickly, one time through, and over to me. Somebody's through. 10%, 20, 30, 50. Some people are really staring at it. Most people are through now. Now, obviously, there are two F's, aren't they? How many found two? There were two. Huh? There are three, right? How many found three? There are three. How many found four? There are four. How many got five? There are five. How many got six? There are six. You believe that? You don't believe it? Well, I have to prove it. Okay, I'll prove it. Now, obviously, two's effective as two, doesn't it? You got those. Three's life has an F in it. But I've never been able to understand why we didn't get one, two, three. Now, the title of this transparency is Aw. Aw. So you can say Aw if you'd like. That's the title of it. Why didn't you count the F's and Aw? Why didn't you see them? Oh, you didn't understand the instructions. That's what was wrong. You've been trained, haven't you? Haven't you been taught to ignore the insignificant? Even though that was the objective, and I told you as clearly as I knew how, to count the number of times the letter F appears. But your perception is one that you've been trained not to perceive them. And it's amazing how many things that we'll pick up, even in our own ministry, about ourselves and other people, that our perception base changes. And we may not perceive it the same way. I think a significant aspect in our whole perception is to look at things, to really see them, to observe them. Some studies have indicated that about 83%, the least I've seen on another study was 75. So from 75 up to 83% anyway, thereabouts, of what you've learned in your life, sources of learning, you learn it through your eyes. About 11% through your ears. So the show and tell of the elementary teacher is quite effective, isn't it? They capitalize on that principle. And don't we do that in the navigators? The things that are effective to us, for us, the hand and the wheel and the bridge, isn't that a show and tell? Have you noticed how much more effective that is than when you just tell a thing without any visuals to go with it? How much easier that is to communicate and to remember. Here's an maybe even more important thing. That after 3 hours, if you only heard it, 70%. If you only saw it, 72%. Not much difference. But if you saw it and heard it, there's 85%. That is a significant difference, but this is more significant. After 3 days, if you only heard it, 10%. If you only saw it, there's twice as much recall. But if you saw it and heard it, 65%. That's 6.5 times what it is if you only heard it. And what do we do? I think our patterns gear so drastically with this. When honestly, what we need to do is consider some more of the show and tell. And you show and tell. You demonstrate. And you don't know what the response is all the time. You have to get a response. Spot is a dog, run, spot, run. And the little guy is called upon to recite. Personally, I think the author's style is redundant, repetitive, and lacking in narrative skill. So you say, what I need for perception is something very simple, that the words will easily be perceived. Right? Now, if there are any single guys, you have to beware of that little statement down there. But here's what they were thinking. This one raises fish in the aquarium, and that one eats fish. So the perception was drastically different. I think the words, let me give you one. I call out a word, and as quickly as you can, you tell me what color it is, right? Car. I heard white and red. So many reds. No blues? Did anybody say blue? We heard there was some blues. Why'd you say blue, John? Did somebody said red? Is there somebody said red who does not have a red car? Why did you say it, John?
It came after yellow and green.
You came out yelling green. Pete, what about you?
I don't know.
Did somebody want a red car? That's the color you wanted? Whatever. The perception is different. You see it in a different manner. I could ask you another one. You tell me what color it is. Ready? Apple.
Red.
No greens? It's a lot more consistent. Of course, I think golden delicious. This came out of Webster's Dictionary. It's a noun. A polyhedron having for its base a polygon and for faces triangles with a common vertex. You know instantly what that is. Does this help? Does that help any? I did that some time ago and a guy said, "Oh yeah, I see it now. It's a palm tree." I said, "Well, if that's the way it looks to you, then that's the way it is." How many of you had any dealings with OSHA? You have. You know that health and safety outfit? I asked one group this week, what do they do? And they said, they make rules. I said, well, if that's your perception. But here's a cowboy, according to OSHA. A blue tail fly on there. Now, there's no way in this world that I could explain that to you, is there? I'd have to show you that animal, because if I started off trying to explain it, that you wouldn't get the perception. It looks differently to different people. One last illustration about that perception. I saw a beautiful little cartoon. I thought I had it with me, but I've lost it somewhere along the way. It was a four cartoon piece. And the first one showed a guy in BC, you know, with a loincloth on. He's got this big old pole and a heavy line. He goes down and throws it in the water. The next instance, it shows a tug on it. The third, he's setting the hook. And the fourth, it shows him being snatched into the water, holding on to the pole, and gators on the bottom pulling him in, and says, "Got another one." So as a fisherman, I saw, well, that takes a weird perspective. That's a weird perception to look at it that way. Of course, I have had gators on the end of a line before, so I could identify with that. And so I thought through this. Perception, what does it look like to you? What does it look like to someone else? And being willing to look at it from someone else's viewpoint. Look not every man on his own things, but where? Also on the things of others. That our perception then, what does it look like? If we use the background and knowledge and experience, and that'll happen in your seminars. If you accept where a person is coming from, you can listen and tell regionalisms. You can hear what they say, but look for meanings in there. And if you don't understand the communication, it's better to ask a question than it is to make a judgment. And the sensitivity of you one to another while you're in this particular course, I think, can be highlighted if you'll focus on some of these issues. And if you get it out of order and somebody reacts, my suggestion is you take it to the Lord in prayer. You go back to Colossians 4:6 one more time and ask Him to give you speech that's always with grace, seasoned with salt, and Him to show you how you ought to answer every person. This afternoon, we'll pick up about where we left off with this model and look at some more things dealing with this process and then go into some other issues.